We've been covering climate change in Kansas City here on KCUR with stories on everything from retrofitting houses to be more energy efficient to the effects of climate change on outdoor concerts and epic grilling in the summertime. What we haven't talked about is how much we drive in Kansas City, and we should, because although industry was consistently the greatest source of emissions in this country for decades, that has changed. In the last couple of years, transportation has become the biggest source of greenhouse gas pollution in the U.S. Cars, trucks, planes, trains, and shipping, but mostly cars and trucks. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And the question today is, can a car-loving city go green? Call 816-235-2888 to weigh in. I want to start by introducing Michael Wells. As the Missouri Valley Special Collections Librarian for the Kansas City Public Library, he will be our history guy today. Hello, Michael.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. When we say that Kansas City is a car culture, what does that mean from a historical standpoint? How far back does our love affair with the automobile go?
Oh, very early on, I would say Kansas Cityans embraced the automobile fad from the early 1900s on. You had automobile clubs spring up around the area that sort of took over the prior fad, which had been the new safety bicycles that were sort of sweeping the nation from about the 1880s, 1890s on.
But, what is a safety bicycle? I don't want to get totally off track,
yeah.
But I am curious.
Well, if you think about early bicycles, a lot of people will envision the kind of penny farthing style, which is the big front wheel. Looks like you might seriously hurt yourself if you ever encountered
really
any difficulty. But the safety bicycles are kind of what you think of when you think of modern bicycles. So the two wheels of equal size and, the basic framework that we have today. But yeah, that was kind of Americans' first taste of sort of transportation freedom and the late 19th century, sort of being able to get around easily and safely. But it was just really hard to compete when automobiles came along and, you know, suddenly you didn't have to, huff and puff your way up the hills.
The idea, you kind of alluded to this just now, but the idea of individual transportation as a very American thing, can you talk to me about that?
Sure, yeah. Getting from place to place is sort of a primal thing. I mean, if it's a trail in the woods from your campsite to the stream, you know, that's just as sort of inherent to the human experience as a four-lane superhighway with clover leaves. We all just want to get where we're going. That in the past people felt very tied to sort of where they were born, where they grew up, their neighborhoods, their locality, and that's great. I mean, you know, it's good to have a sense of those things, but there is sort of that urge to breathe free, and I think that is very American.
So what factors would you say set us up as, I guess, early adopters of the car and a place that would be eager to embrace this new technology? Is it geography? Is it something else?
Well, I think there's a couple of different things that come to mind. One of them is geography. If you think about Kansas City, it's relatively flat and spreads out in sort of all directions, which is conducive to road building. If you travel out west, you can get into the mountainous areas. You'll kind of see how the geography sort of hems a city in. You know, there's only so much that can be done in terms of road building and sprawl and development and that sort of thing. But
yes.
Kansas City never really had that. Communities sprung up all over the place, you know, Lee Summit and Smithville and, you know, the cities west into Kansas. And
as a result of the car?
I would say probably predates that. I think that's probably more of a result of just the agriculture in the area. You know,
uh-huh.
There's so much land to be cultivated, and but yeah, then that led to people needing to sort of get goods from point A to point B, and a lot of times that was done by rail and stuff like that. But certainly the automobile factored in as well.
Did our city initially have to adapt fairly dramatically to accommodate this giant driving machine that is so vastly different from the safety bicycle?
Yeah, you know, in the early 1900s, around 1916, we got our first sort of federal highway legislation that helped local cities and states fund highway construction. But that's a little bit deceptive because a lot of these roads were still sort of rocky, unpaved, you know, difficult to travel affairs, you know, not what you think of today when you say the word highway or expressway. So we did need to get building. Luckily here in Kansas City, or, you know, depending on your political perspectives, the Pendergast machine was sort of an early adopter of road improvements in the area. Tom Pendergast was made superintendent of streets as one of his first political appointments. And I think he really learned the lesson that voters really do sort of care first and foremost about the quality of the roads they're traveling on than, say, maybe what's going on in City Hall.
So can you track how Kansas City and the car evolved in tandem from there, sort of major milestones along that way?
Yeah. So I mentioned the Pendergast machine just now, and of course, the boss Tom helped Harry S. Truman become presiding judge of Jackson County. During his tenure there, he made sort of continuing road improvements in Jackson County as a whole a top priority. Later in 1931, I believe, Kansas City initiated its 10-year plan, which was sort of a Great Depression combating program of public improvements. And so that's where we get our City Hall and our Jackson County Courthouse, Municipal Auditorium, things like that. But we also get a focus on the county roads as well. So that's all going on at the same time. I mean, these are all kind of national trends as well. You know, Kansas City's not different in that regard, but we certainly kind of led the charge in that sense.
Why is it that when other cities were getting subways or elevated trains, we just didn't?
That's something I haven't thought a lot about. We did have a small amount of elevated tracks here in Kansas City, and of course our one tunnel, the 8th Street Tunnel, that everyone loves to remember.
But
you're right. It did not happen on the scale, and I think if I have to just maybe draw a conclusion, I would say that it's just the geography of Kansas City and the way it developed. It's just a more difficult prospect to sort of link up these far-flung communities than it is, you know, through things like subways and built-up rail. Although we did have a fairly vast network of interurban trains, but it's just more difficult in terms of funding and construction.
So you have done a lot of research on urban renewal, and the story of white flight has had an impact on housing, real estate, development. That's, I guess, putting it pretty mildly. How does that story relate to the primacy of the car?
Well, I think it kind of goes back to what we're talking about that sense of freedom that comes along with mobility. We think of that as generally a positive thing, but if you think about it in the sense of white flight, it can be, you know, some of its more negative aspects do come out if people have a perception that maybe their neighborhood is on the decline for whatever reason, and they have the ability to kind of relocate to another area of the city where they don't necessarily have to worry about getting to work in an efficient way, an efficient public way, then they can certainly do that. And that has definitely occurred in Kansas City. I don't think it takes any kind of expert to tell you that.
Well, Michael Wells of the Missouri Valley Room, hang on a sec. I want to bring Angie Schmidt into this conversation. She's a transportation writer based in Cleveland, and she has written an article called "We Can't Stop Global Warming Without Reducing Driving." Hi, Angie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So at the risk of making a horrible pun, our reliance on cars is really where the rubber meets the road, and, you know, especially on climate change. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So we've made a lot of progress in the U.S. Reducing emissions from electricity and some other sectors. but transportation has been stubbornly high, and it's gotten worse in recent years. We're driving more than we did just a few years ago, and we're driving bigger cars. There's been a real movement towards SUVs in recent years, and that's a strain on resources.
So a lot of people seem to have the idea that it's really air travel that we should be paying attention to. Is that when you see the overall sources of emissions when it comes to transportation, when you break that down, it is actually driving that makes up the bulk of that, right?
Yeah, definitely. Air travel has been a little bit of a focus because it's one area that they don't imagine will be electrified anytime soon. So there aren't a lot of prospects for reducing those kind of emissions compared to driving. But we're just getting started on looking at how to approach this problem. Besides like electric vehicles, there hasn't been a lot of progress made to this point. And there's not even a lot of consensus about how to approach it.
So how would you state the problem of cars as they relate to climate change right now? How would you state like where we are and what we're dealing with in just the most concrete terms possible?
We've talked a little bit about like some of the history, and when cars came into the mainstream, like in the early 1900s, cities and metro areas were completely redesigned around cars, and Kansas City is a great example. I mean, probably almost everywhere in Kansas City, there's a law that says if you build a building for commercial uses, an office, a store, it's got to have a certain number of parking spaces. It's got to have X number of parking spaces, and everyone who travels to your store isn't going to have to pay to park. It's going to be free, and we're going to wrap the cost of that parking into whatever goods they buy. So our whole communities are engineered around easy car access. And it's gotten to the point, I mean, the previous guest mentioned freedom, but I think it's gotten to the point where it's actually pretty oppressive. Most people, or a lot of people in the United States can't make any trips by foot or bike, or hardly ever do that because it's just not safe. We haven't come back through and provided the safe sidewalks, the safe crossings that would give people all options and alternatives outside of driving for every trip.
Well, you're kind of getting to this now, but what is the challenge for cities and maybe even especially Midwestern, mid-sized cities? Because for individuals to really ditch their cars, cities need to work for people without cars.
Yeah, I mean, it would take a big paradigm change. And some cities are a lot farther along than a place like Kansas City. Like I was just out in Portland. And this is a big part of the culture there. And there's a lot of people working on it. And you go downtown in downtown Portland on a Sunday, and the sidewalks are full of people and there's hardly any cars, but you look up and you see trains passing in every direction. So it is possible, but it's a lot of work.
Well, and I want to jump in and say, Michael Wells was just describing the geography that makes Kansas City conducive to a car culture, which is that there's no geographical barrier to us going on and on and on. And Portland is the opposite of that. Portland is totally hemmed in.
Portland, one thing that's interesting and a little bit wonky is Portland has what's called an urban growth boundary. So politically, they've limited the amount of sprawl that can happen sort of on the periphery. And I think that's been really effective. And Kansas City, I've seen used as a sort of a bad example of regional planning, where there isn't a whole lot of regional power that limits that sprawling growth out on the fringes. And those are that kind of growth really, it really boosts driving miles. We have the same problem in Cleveland where we don't even have regional population growth where we have a lot of new residents, but we're still developing out into the green fields at the very periphery of the region. It's been really negative for our region.
Well, hang on. I'm speaking with Angie Schmidt. She is a transportation writer, but I want to bring Daniel Serta in now. He's with us from LISC. He's a city planner, and I want to get his take on what the particular challenges are and will be for Kansas City. Hi, Daniel.
Good morning.
So, challenges. I know you have what you see as like some optimistic perspective,
sure.
And we'll get to that. Mm-hmm. What are the challenges?
Well, you just upbraided because to me the challenge is the opportunity, but I'll hold that thought.
Yeah, do.
The challenge, I think, the principal challenge is that we have close to 70 years of policy, specifically in infrastructure investment policy throughout the Kansas City metropolitan area, that has become basically our habit. When we think of growth in terms of regional growth, we think about it geographically. And the consequence of that over those 70 years has been that we've actually had relatively modest growth as a metropolitan region.
But in terms of something else, like population?
In terms of population. We've grown at about 2 to 3% a year for most of that 70 years, which in aggregate is impressive. I mean, it means there's communities that the population is quadrupled, others where it's doubled. There are other regions that have grown at 20 and 30% over, you know, the span of a decade. The challenge is we've grown our land use, our land consumption, at a factor about 5 to 10 times that, depending which part of the metropolitan area you're talking about. In Wyandotte County, I think it's closer to 5 times. In Kansas City, Missouri, it's more like 10 times.
Can you explain what growing our land use means?
So we've expanded our municipal boundaries of individual cities geographically at a level, in terms of acreage, that far exceeds the proportion of growth in our population, which means fewer people spread over a much larger land area, which by definition means everyone has to travel farther to do anywhere within the metropolitan area to do things that most people took for granted 50 years ago. Things as simple as going to the grocery store or especially going to and from work.
So what does this mean for like the individual who just wants to make a good choice?
Well, it's really hard. There's a very sharp constraint on the choices that you have available to you. The optimistic part is that the choices are broadening, but that's really a consequence of the last 10 to 15 years. Before then, it was very difficult to make a choice to live in an area that was more walkable.
Call 816-235-2888 to join our conversation about whether Kansas City can reimagine itself as a place where car is not king. 816-235-2888. What has your experience been? We'll hear those stories and perspectives when we return. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about the role of cars in the climate change equation, and we've been asking what it would take for Kansas Cityans to drive less or ditch their cars altogether. I've been chatting with Michael Wells of the Missouri Valley Room at the Kansas City Public Library about the history of car culture in Kansas City, and Daniel Serta, a city planner with LISC. He is also in the studio. Hi again, you guys.
Morning.
Hello.
We are joined as well by Angie Schmidt. She is a transportation writer who is with us on the line from Cleveland. Hi again, Angie.
Hi there.
So I'm going to take a quick call before I go back to asking questions, and you can join us as well at 816-235-2888. I want to hear from Jake in Olathe. Hi, Jake.
Hi there, Gina. Thanks for taking my call, and I always appreciate your stories. I've been listening to you for years. And this is a particularly interesting discussion today. So from my perspective, I'm just a regular old consumer, and there's a lot of limitations on what I can do about this issue. But one of the things I was exploring recently is what the cost was of, you know, moving over to an electric vehicle for my internal combustion engine car. And what I found after running the numbers is that the operating costs for pretty much any electric car on the market are substantially lower than running a gasoline car. So I ran the numbers looking at the fuel cost and the cost savings of not having to do an oil change over the 200,000 mile lifespan of a vehicle. And that's about $20,000 in fuel costs and oil changes on a standard internal combustion engine car that does 30 miles per gallon. And what I found for the Nissan Leaf and Tesla's newest model, the Model 3, if I remember right, is that that cost is closer to $5,000. So for me, I think the knowledge that the economics have flipped on their head is not real widespread at this time. And I think that it's very important to get that message out. The fact is, right now, if you are a budget consumer, if you don't want to spend more than you have to on your transportation, the only viable option for improving that very much is to buy an electric car.
Okay, Jake, I'm going to get some response to this. And I also do want to say we haven't really talked about public transit and other options that depending on who is doing this math and where they live and all sorts of other factors might be another option. And we'll get to that. But for now, Angie Schmidt, talk to me about whether we can electric car our way out of this problem. Just keep on driving without the fuel.
Yeah. I mean, I do think electric cars are going to be a big part of the solution. We definitely have to, we have to convert our fleet from internal combustion engines to electric cars, and we have to do it quickly. And not only that, but we have to convert our electricity grid to be renewable or more renewable in a tight time frame to avoid the worst effects of climate change. That's sort of without question. But in addition to that, that Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says we also need to reduce the amount of driving we're doing in the United States by about 20%.
Period. So electric or not?
Yes. Right.
Why is that? Can you explain it?
What they're doing is they're doing projections to meet the threshold we need to have our emissions in 11 years in order to avoid the 2% Celsius increase in temperature that scientists think will be really disastrous. So when they model that, they find like electric vehicles is very important and will do a lot of the heavy lifting, but it's not sufficient on its own. We also need to be increasing the number of trips that are happening by foot and bike or transit, or maybe telecommuting or carpooling, different strategies like that.
You know, Angie, maybe this is beyond what you can answer, but I was looking this morning at these sort of breakdowns of our emissions and what sectors they come from. And I mentioned that transportation was first, but the production of electricity was second. And so I also kind of wonder if that's part of what we need to think about when we talk about electric cars.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people that study this are a little less worried about the field of electricity because of the way things are going. The price of solar, the price of wind is dropping, the price of coal is becoming less and less competitive. So I think people sort of feel like the winds are a little bit at our back at that sector. And transportation, I mean, there is a bright spot with this vehicle electrification, and there is a lot of growth in recent years in electric vehicles. But on some of these other metrics, we're not making much progress, and in fact, are getting worse.
Call 816-235-2888 with your perspective on whether Kansas City can give up its car-loving ways, or if that's just totally unimaginable to you, and if so, why? 816-235-2888. Daniel, we will get to those calls, but first, you are in some ways here to make the case that we are already seeing the beginnings of change. I'd like you to explain that and give some examples.
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on. The first is that during the recession, people probably forget this now because we've been at $230 gas for a little while, but gas jumped up to nearly $4 a gallon, simultaneous with people losing their jobs and finding it more difficult to pay for a mortgage. And that was the first to me reckoning of the system that we've built for moving people around the city, is that it became incredibly expensive for people to move around. It has always been true in relative terms that it costs more to move around and to own as many automobiles as we do that most people really kind of consciously calculate. We often tout the livability of Kansas City from the perspective of the cost of living with regard to our cost of housing. About 15 years ago, some researchers in Chicago came up with what they called with the housing plus transportation cost burden index. And the idea was that in many Midwestern cities, if you combine the cost of transportation with the cost of housing.
Yeah, so you're looking at car insurance, you're looking at
exactly,
getting those new tags.
Roughly $10,000 per car per year. Let's just be blunt about it. What you actually end up with in most Midwestern cities are cities that are not any more affordable than the very expensive housing markets on the coast, which are much more compact, much more dense, and much more walkable, and much more amenable to people traveling without using and relying on as many cars. So, you know, the cost curve has sort of stared us in the face, and I think that's also worked in tandem with generational change that's happening. I think there are many, many people, especially as our downtown has been revitalized and has grown that are much more drawn toward the idea of a walkable urban lifestyle. I remember talking to people about this 30 years ago, and they looked at me like I had three heads. And they said, nobody wants to do that, especially in Kansas City. That's the way it was 50 years ago. It's never going to be that way again. Nobody ever wants to go there again. And the reality is the cycle has shifted. And there are a lot of people now that are actively looking for choice. Again, the market is not providing as much of that choice. I would say there's a lot of pent-up demand now for walkable urban, but you're seeing that in new development trends, even far out in the suburbs.
Give me some examples.
We have great examples of what I would call walkable urban development happening really far from downtown, like Lenexa City Center or Park Place in Leawood or earlier Zona Rosa up in the Northland. People are drawn to those kinds of people places that, you know, part of the urban design character of them is that fundamentally they're about experiencing places on foot. They're about experiencing an environment where you're coming face-to-face and having informal interactions with people you don't know. The kind of thing that, again, 75, 100 years ago, you would hear city planners and others railing against about how horrible and how disorienting and how uncomfortable that was in the city and how people were, you know, going to seek to go out to the greener pasture so that they could have quiet and solitude and not that kind of chaos of the city. People are drawn to other people, and they're looking for experiences, and particularly younger people. I was telling someone the other day, when the downtown council set the goal 15 year or so years ago of drawing 10,000 new residents to downtown Kansas City, there were people that openly said, this is ludicrous. It's never going to happen. In that time, they have more than doubled that accomplishment. There are more than 20,000 people living in downtown Kansas City now that didn't 15 years ago. But again, it's not just downtown. It's a lot of peripheral neighborhoods, the West Side, Strawberry Hill and KCK, Beacon Hill in Kansas City, Missouri on the east side, and others that are drawing people who were drawn to that kind. They're looking for that kind of lifestyle.
Michael Wells, what's your perspective just historically on the sort of shift that Daniel is talking about? This, oh, well, it was like that, what you would now say 80 years ago, that 30 years ago, people thought, you know, this was never going to come back, this time when people wanted to go places on their feet, for example.
Well, I do think it is important, as someone who has studied the urban renewal era quite a bit, that we realize that those leaders, policymakers, elected officials were really responding to the trends of the time and what.
I'm going to just jump in and say, when we talk about the urban renewal era, what are
sure.
we talking about?
I'm really speaking of sort of post-war, so post-World War II America, this drive to sort of reinvent American cities, to sort of facilitate the suburbs, to just redefine sort of modern life in America. And then a lot of federal funding coming into cities to help make that possible.
Okay, so go on with your point.
So I think that they were really responding to the trends of the day. I don't think that they were doing these things necessarily to be evil or to be looked at with derision several decades later. Their tax bases were moving to the suburbs. So they were doing what they could to sort of hold on to those tax bases, to appease those voters. It would have been difficult for them to sort of look forward several decades and try to anticipate what was going to happen. I think that also speaks to something that Daniel brought up when he mentioned the index of home costs plus vehicle costs. I think that things need to make economic sense for them to happen. As someone who studies history, you see that the big economic booms and sort of cycles of reinvention in American cities, be it driven by industry or some other type of business or something, they happen because they're responding to things that are happening and that are benefiting people's lives, that are changing people's lives. So I think, you know, the caller previously mentioned that we just don't know, it's just not widely known the efficiency of these electrical vehicles. But I think as time goes on and fuel prices continue to rise, we're going to see that, you know, if a green economy is going to take off, it's going to be because it makes sense.
Let's talk to one of our callers. We've got Robin in Midtown with us. Hi, Robin.
Yes, I had to call in this morning. I listen to you all the time, but this is a topic that really, really wanted to weigh in on. My boyfriend and I, we live in Hyde Park, and we commute on our bicycles to Westport every day. We do our groceries on our bicycle. We, for entertainment purposes, we use our bicycle. We use it for just about everything. If we, so I think it's a lifestyle change. I think people in America need to start living closer to where they work. I think we overconsume in this country. I don't think we need to be, you know, we don't really need to hop in a car and drive to the burbs to some big box store. We just simply need to live simpler, much simpler lives like they do in Europe and other countries. So I say ditch the car altogether. I have a car, and honestly, I move it maybe once a month.
Robin, I have a question for you. So when most of us go to high school in this country, I believe this is still true, you get driver's ed. That's like part of what you do as part of like coming of age in America. You get driver's ed. And I think not everyone has the confidence and skill that you seem to have when it comes to navigating an American city on bike, and particularly an American city that was built for cars. And I'm curious how you developed that confidence and skill, and what words of advice you would have for someone who maybe wants to do exactly what you're talking about, but feels either intimidated or just sort of like there's something they're not able to quite figure out.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I definitely didn't utilize my bicycle like I do before. And then my boyfriend 6 years ago, he's from Europe, so but he showed me the way. I saw his lifestyle. He didn't own a car. He, you know, made a point to live close to where he worked. If he had to go somewhere further, he figured out, you know, how to use the public transit system. So just getting online. I mean, there's apps, or you can get online to figure out the bus schedule. I mean, worst comes to worst, and we you know, we're too tired, or we need to go a little bit further, maybe down the hill to Crossroads or downtown. We'll just walk a block away, and there's a bus stop. So, and they've got, you know, the schedule on the bus stop right there on the marquee, and it tells you when the next bus is coming. But like I said, you can get online and figure out the bus schedule.
Okay.
And or just walk too. I mean, yeah. Sometimes I just like to get on my two legs.
Okay. Thank you, Robin. Daniel, Robin, you spoke earlier about planning habits. Yeah. Robin is talking about a different kind of habits. And of course, when people need jobs and don't have a lot of choices about where they will work or where they will live, mm-hmm. what she's describing might not be accessible. But talk to me about the role of habit in this whole thing.
Well, individual habits, again, like I said, I think there's a resurgence of interest or consumer interest in this, but it's limited by availability of choices out there in the market. But you are seeing this beginning to transfer over into public policy. There are municipalities, Kansas City, North Kansas City in particular, as well as some of the Johnson County municipalities, that have actively, over the last decade or so, begun prioritizing investments in alternative transportation, basically creating bikeways and on-street bike paths. That infrastructure is, you know, orders of magnitude less costly than trying to build out additional capacity for automobiles on roadways. But what hasn't quite happened yet, it's just the beginnings of a conversation here that places like Portland are far ahead of us on, is we have entire ingrained patterns of development standards, particularly parking requirements associated with development, that are all premised on basically 1950s era thinking about the idea that everyone will be arriving at any destination in an automobile by themselves. And the challenge with that is we not only have to reduce the parking requirements, but we also need to think much more conscientiously in policy terms about the kinds of accommodations that developers need to be expected to make for alternative forms of transportation. That's everything from where they actually site and locate development to how they accommodate development within those larger projects. And we're just at a very early stage of that. It's a hard conversation to have, but it's one that's beginning. I think over the next decade or so, that's the one where you're going to see lots of change happen. And I just want to mention real quickly, the bigger challenge that's out there that there's growing appreciation for at both the local and the regional level is we have built an infrastructure to accommodate automobiles that, you know, if you wanted to put a paper value to it, it's probably close. You know, it's in the tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars. We don't have the ongoing operational resources to maintain and continue expanding that network at the scale that we have. And that's really forced a lot of our choices. And it's going to be forcing even harder choices over time as federal support for those investments continues to decline about whether and how we continue to do that. So I think that's also something that's, you know, as a background factor, is beginning to shift the conversation and the focus onto alternative forms of mobility.
Let's talk quickly to Kathleen in Volker. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. I had two things, probably don't have time. I just want to say I was moved into Volker in 1979, my husband and I thinking that the city was going to revitalize then. And I was just furious when they wanted to choose between fast transit or transit to the airport or additional parking. And that they chose, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5 acres more of parking rather than getting started on mass transit. I mean, it would save the time, it would save the environment. And just, I am going to be 70 this next year, and I have been waiting and waiting for rail to get to where I can walk to it so that I can get rid of my car or garage it. I mean, it's just infuriating.
Yeah.
I mean, we're getting the density now. We just got to educate the people, and it's going to cost money, just like the sewer system that we're replacing now, which is costing so much more than
Kathleen,
if we had done it.
I'm going to jump in here and ask Daniel Serta. Daniel, we have not talked a lot about the role of public transit in all of this, and Kathleen brought up the word density. She says we have the density now. Do you agree with that? We have the density to make public transit our primary.
We do in certain areas. Right now, Kansas City Area Transportation Authority is doing a study that will launch next year in terms of recommendations. But basically, that's looking at trying to prioritize frequency of service, which makes service much more accessible to a broader range of people over sort of the distribution geographically of service. So we're working at the margins in terms of the existing system. But to the bigger point that Kathleen is making in terms of major enhancements, particularly building out the streetcar system and building alternative we have you know, an advantage now that there's a focus policy-wise, and there's a conversation going on about that in leadership circles. We also have the deficit that didn't happen 20 or 25 years ago when there was actually a fair amount of momentum behind building a light rail system. But again, we're going to be chained to the choices that we made 20 years ago as we move forward.
Well, we are going to have to go pretty quickly. But Angie, before we do, I want to give us a something to feel optimistic about. Tell us about what a city has done with an infrastructure originally intended for cars to transform.
Yeah, so the two cities that are the best examples that I can think of that have reduced that amount
the
of
twin
driving
cities.
Miles, even though they're growing pretty quickly, that's Minneapolis and Seattle. Seattle has added a ton of light rail. They just approved another $50 billion in spending, and they're doing a lot with bikes and with bike infrastructure and infill development as well. And in Minneapolis, they've also invested a lot in bike infrastructure. They have a really great system of bike infrastructure. But in addition, they've just had a lot of infill development. They've had a lot of like multifamily apartment buildings built in walkable areas back in their sort of their urban core. And just doing that, there's a bit of an apartment boom going on, or there had been in recent years. If you can sort of harness that a little bit and get it into your more walkable neighborhoods in Kansas City, that's one way that you can move the needle a little bit and give more people access to an environment where they can walk for at least some trips.
Angie Schmidt, Michael Wells, Daniel Serta, thank you all so much.
Absolutely. Appreciate being here.
Keep talking about this on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. Up next, a new international study on bisexuality and aging is the first of its kind. We'll meet the KU professor behind that work on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're joined by Sarah Jen, an assistant professor in the KU School of Social Welfare. And in partnership with a colleague in the UK, she has conducted the first international study to look at bisexuality and aging. Sarah Jen, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Tell me about that study and what it revealed.
Sure. So this was a study that we were asked to compare two studies that were done very similarly, one in the United States in the Pacific Northwest region and one in the UK, both with older bisexual individuals. And we were asked to produce something that would start to move towards an international empirical, literature base, because there's currently nothing out there on international comparisons and how we understand bisexuality across historical and cultural periods, across these different national barriers. So we ended up comparing findings from our two studies and ended up finding that there were some shared cultural narratives and historical time periods and events, and some that were rather distinctive.
Can you explain that? I mean, what kinds of narratives seem to emerge from your research?
Sure. So among the bisexual women in particular, the resonance of the lesbian separatist movement was actually shared between the two locations. I don't know if you're familiar with the lesbian separatist movement, but in the context of the second wave feminist movement, there was this development within lesbian communities of wanting to move towards women-only spaces and women-only communities. And Ty Grace Atkinson, who was an activist during that period, is famous for saying, "Feminism is the philosophy, lesbianism is the practice." But what this effectively did was remove the role of bisexual women from women-only spaces. By remaining open to relationships with men, they were, in a sense, betraying the cause. So there is this historical tension between lesbian and bisexual communities that's still deeply felt by older bisexual women today, especially those who came out earlier in life and were a part of that movement or came of age around lesbians of a similar age.
You found some health outcomes relating to where bisexuality and the aging process intersect as well.
Well, with this study, we were kind of trying to understand health disparities. So we've found within the literature that bisexual women in particular report mental health disparities above and beyond those reported by older lesbians, which was somewhat surprising to a lot of people, I would say, because we've been kind of told this narrative that bisexual people are doing okay, that they have the power of passing privilege, that they might be protected in some sense from forms of victimization, discrimination. But what we've been finding is that that's actually not necessarily the case, that they have identity-related issues, confusion, a lack of importance of that identity, but all those things also contribute to a lack of disclosure of their sexual identity, which then limits their access to social support. So there's kind of this pathway towards health that's limiting for both bisexual men and women. And we wanted to better understand that and understand if these individuals are struggling with internalized stigma, where does that come from? And how is that kind of culturally and historically informed?
What did you find?
Well, so the lesbian separatist movement was one piece of that. For bisexual men in particular, in both the UK and US studies, the impact of the AIDS epidemic was the largest historical time period that came out in terms of its relevance to identity formation. Within empirical literature and just cultural narratives, this was a space in which bisexual men were discussed and talked about as kind of sexual pariahs and not safe sexual partners, not safe political allies either. And this was a space in which bisexual stigma really deepened. But in some ways, the AIDS epidemic also offered kind of a space of LGBTQ community building, that there was so much necessary support within the community that many of our participants contributed to that directly by offering bereavement supports. Some people said that they went home and were nervous to listen to their voice messages, just wondering who had died that day, because it was such a common thing that was happening during that period of their lives. So in some ways, it's this shared sense of historical and cultural trauma that's specific to the community. And in some ways, it serves to hold them together with other sexual and gender minorities.
So backing up just a moment, what made you think this was a topic that demanded investigation?
Well, as a young bisexual person myself, I've been identifying as bisexual for a little over a decade now, and I can remember being told frequently that bisexual people were probably doing okay, that there's this kind of cultural narrative that we're probably not experiencing health disparities or not experiencing undue trauma or stigma or any mental health concerns. And I started working as a doctoral student on this large federally funded national study of LGBTQ older adults. And what we found was that there's actually very high rates of both depression, anxiety, as well as suicidal ideation among older bisexual individuals. And this seemed like such a ripe area for examination. And we had so little information about what their lives looked like, about the experience of, we know that there are certain factors that are related to these health outcomes, identity factors, social factors, but we don't really know how they come about over someone's life course.
Why do
how
you
does
think
that experience build?
Why do you think the work hadn't been done before?
There's so much invisibility around this population. We found that even when trying to recruit individuals, it's extremely hard to find people who both identify as bisexual and are over the age of 50 or over the age of 60. There isn't necessarily a central location for this community to come together specifically around their sexual identity. And in a lot of ways, they're kind of pushed to the off-center locations within the broader sexual and gender minority community as well. And there's a lot of, I would say, ongoing, continuing bisexual stereotypes and stigma that relate to that. It gives people the sense that bisexuality isn't necessarily a strong political identity, a community identity. So I think there are barriers when it comes to people even using that term to describe themselves.
What does that have to do with aging?
Well, I think we're at a really interesting historical moment in terms of political context around LGBTQ issues. This is a space in which we've seen drastic shifts in terms of how the population has been viewed, overall acceptance, policy change as well. So I think there's a need to understand just how much has changed, as well as understanding how our elders within our community have contributed to the rights that we have today. So I think there's definitely a need for a building of intergenerational community. And this space is also one in which terminology changes quickly, which serves to sometimes separate generations of LGBTQ individuals, that issues of terminology, differences of experience, identities that are available today were not available 10, 15, 20 years ago. So there's this kind of this need, I think, to share knowledge, to acknowledge our elders, and to kind of share that intergenerational history moving forward.
You know, you have mentioned that this is personal for you, and I know that academics don't like to think about things in terms of good and bad, but when you talk about some of, especially like this depression and anxiety, with that, some aspects of the news being like what many people would call like not good news, how do you frame that for yourself? How do you kind of respond to that, and what do you make of it?
Well, I've actually been doing aging work before I started doing bisexuality work, and one of the ways that I think about that is that by being invested in aging, we're kind of investing in ourselves. It's one of those minorities that we'll all eventually be a part of because we're aging into it. We can all anticipate this aging future for ourselves. And by contributing to a literature base, research, interventions, we can actually create the aging future that we want for ourselves. And I find that very motivating.
Yeah, that's super inspiring. Sarah Jen, Assistant KU Professor of Social Welfare, our time is up, but thank you for your time.
Thank you.
If there is anything from today's show that you didn't catch but want to, we'll have it all ready for you at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. And while you're there, you might want to just sign up to have these conversations sent right to you like a podcast. It's super convenient. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, impeachment hearings are expected to happen during this particular time slot. So do keep talking to us on Twitter and telling us what you want to discuss. when it's back to us. We're at KCUR CST, and we're all about that local angle. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.